Welcome to another edition of Hanging Out with Ted McKay. And today I have a friend from years and years ago that I've kept up with. And now he's in Minnesota. So
Minnesota.
I have to say, this man is responsible for me being on the airwaves in Dallas. Because 20 plus years ago, back in 2000, I believe, I sent a tape to him. And he called me up one day and said, hey, how would you like to work for us? And I was like, sure, man. I'd love to work at a major market station. And there I planted my ass for 20 years. So, ladies and gentlemen, Jay Philpott.
Thank you, Ted. You know, I think you're auditioning again, because if you can say the name Minnesota correctly, then, yeah, you're ready to go on the radio and play some audio for the people up here. You betcha.
How you been?
Good. How are you?
I cannot complain. Now, I know we, Minneapolis has been in the news with the George Floyd verdict and everything and all that went on, and plus some other things in the area. So we got to touch on that. That just wouldn't be professional just to kind of just blow it off. But
I'll tell you something. This past week was one of the busiest, most consequential, and most incredible, interesting weeks in my entire life, I think, because there was so much going on that was so focused on this state, this moment, and everything that's going on around us. So consider that Monday began, and that was those were the closing arguments for the trial, and it went to the jury. And then Tuesday, some more deliberations, and ultimately the verdict in the afternoon. Walter Mondale had passed away. And, of course, he is one of the biggest political names to ever come out of this state, you know, right up along Hubert Humphrey. And that was a big deal and a very emotional moment. The verdict came down, and thankfully it was the, three out of three guilty, and the city did not have any bad consequences, which, you know, we were fearing. Then the next day, Wednesday, was the fifth anniversary of Prince's passing. And that was, again, another bittersweet day. There were a lot of people that were celebrating his life at Paisley Park, which is in the southwest part of the metro in a suburb called Chanhassen. But that's where he lived, and that's where his multi-million-dollar studio and soundstage, Paisley Park, is located. So they had about 1,400 people go there to celebrate his life in a free visitation. And then on Thursday was the funeral of the young man that was also shot during the trial in Brooklyn Center, just 8 miles away from downtown Minneapolis. Friday was a pretty calm day, and we all needed it. So, yeah, it's been a busy week. But as far as what we do on the radio around that is try to reflect it and, try to be present without, at least for a music station like mine, without dragging people through it, because they're really not there to listen for that kind of content. They're there for escape. I work for a kind of a soft AC radio station that, plays the softer side of 80s pop, mm-hmm. and also our classic rock station here in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's a pretty long answer. So, crazy week.
Speaking of Prince, now, I know how it is being in Dallas-Fort Worth, Stevie Ray Vaughan being from Dallas. We all love Stevie, you know, especially for the popularity that he brought to Dallas. And I was talking to a guy last week, Tommy Katona, and he was saying he arrived here in 2007 on Stevie's birthday. And I tell you, if you ever come to Dallas and Tommy and his band, Texas Flood, are playing, just walk in, sit down, close your eyes. It's like Stevie Ray Vaughan all over again. And speaking of Stevie Ray Vaughan, I don't want to bring this up, but I have to touch on it. You were there when the crash occurred, right?
Well, yes. There's nothing wrong with bringing it up, because it's actually a story that brought a lot of peace to a lot of fans and to his brother, to Jimmy. Mm-hmm. Let me set the table on that. I've, been in classic rock radio for a long, long, long time, and we're going to go back to 1990, and I'm working at a station called Laser 103 in Milwaukee, and we were the official presenting station for Alpine Valley Music Theater, which means that we gave away lots of tickets to the show. We promoted all the shows. We did live broadcasts. We all had, backstage access to go interview the bands. Some of the most fun and some of the craziest experiences I've ever had were in the 3 years that we were part of that. And Stevie Ray Vaughan was playing in late August of 1990, along with Eric Clapton, the Fabulous Thunderbirds, Buddy Guy. It was a great blues festival that was traveling the country. And he did the two shows, which I attended both because I had done the broadcast. And when the second show was over, it's a fairly warm August night, kind of misty, the clouds were low. He decided he wanted to go back to Chicago a little bit earlier than usual. And so he got on a helicopter that maybe ordinarily wouldn't have carried him. And the helicopter, as it rose up, let me explain. Alpine Valley Music Theater is not only a big concert venue, but it's located as part of a larger complex with a really nice golf course. Mm-hmm. And in the wintertime, they have a hotel and chalet complex for people that like to come and ski on this very large man-made ski hill. Now, that part of southeast Wisconsin is naturally hilly already, but they had constructed a really nice ski hill with a big chairlift that takes you all the way to the top. So it's a little bit higher than the other terrain around it. And with the darkness of night and the low clouds and the mistiness and the fog that was there, as the helicopter rose up to take a turn towards Chicago, because, again, Alpine is kind of the same distance from Chicago as it is to Milwaukee, it hit the top of the ski hill. And so I got a call the next morning at about 6 a.m. from my boss, who knew I had the station van and all the broadcast equipment. I hadn't returned it yet. I just came home from that concert the night before. And he wanted me to get back down there because of this crash. And when I got down there, the press was beginning to assemble. It was something like 7 o'clock at this point. And I had a friend that lived in the area. And he came down and got me. And we actually left the property and drove around the back roads till we came to the other side of the property. So we then got out of the car and walked through some forest and up the hill a little bit, and came upon the crash site. And I just quietly observed what was going on. There were people from all kinds of different jurisdictions, the FAA, the National Transportation and Safety Board, you know, Walworth County, Wisconsin, Wisconsin State Patrol, East Troy Police. I mean, you name it. They were just, you know, investigating. They were taking pictures, and they were noting positions of aircraft, of helicopter parts, and the bodies had not been moved yet. So I just stood and looked and watched and observed and stood fairly close to Stevie, and it was clearly him. And quite frankly, he was lying rather peacefully. He still had his hat on. It was not a gory thing because there was, you know, it's not like the rotors had done damage to people and there wasn't a fire. It was just a pure impact crash. Mm-hmm. And the really odd thing about it, there are two odd things that struck me at that moment, is that it wasn't that far from the crest of the top of the hill. I mean, if that helicopter had had 20 more feet of altitude, they would have missed it. Mm-hmm. But it was also kind of a peaceful scene because, you know, it was late August. It was still very green. It was warm. You could hear birds chirping. It was, in that sense, just kind of peaceful. So then I decided, instead of going back with my friend to the car and then driving back to where my van was and where all the people at the press were assembling, I walked down underneath the ski lift, where I was met by some authorities who wanted to know who the hell I was and what I was doing on that side of their police line. And they almost arrested me, and I explained that I was, you know, the press, trying to cover and get some information for the broadcast, and they not so nicely suggested I get back out to the parking lot, and I did. So I did the report, and I don't really remember what I said, and there's no tape of it, but I was told it was, you know, obviously an emotional report. Sure. So that's August of 1990. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, here we are about 10 years later, and of course, I'm working with Dallas. You've come on to the Air staff. You know how much we all loved and respected John Dillon, the great afternoon guy of KZPS for so many years.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. And I told John that story. And John happened to be very good friends with Jimmy Vaughn. And so at some point, John had told Jimmy the story and then came back to me one day and said, I told Jimmy your story. He would like to meet you. And I said, well, okay. I mean, I don't know what I can tell him. I mean, he was there. He had to make the ID and, you know, he's read all the reports. And I guess Jimmy's reaction was that he had seen the real, you know, harsh clinical professional evaluation of what happened and that he kind of wanted to hear my firsthand account, which obviously is a little softer, you know?
Sure.
And so in telling that story, I remember him thanking me and truly feeling, I can't tell you how he felt, but I think, and I would hope that he walked away feeling a little bit better about that, you know, it wasn't the horrible scene that so many people imagine a crash like that could be.
Mm-hmm.
But the really weird thing was when it happened, again, it was at the top of the ski hill, which just rises above the golf course and the part of the parking lot where thousands of people were still walking to their cars. And the ski hill is less than half a mile away and maybe 1,000 feet up. So, you know, as the crow flies, just a matter of a few thousand yards, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody heard a thing. Nobody saw a thing.
Really?
They didn't even realize it was missing until 4 or 5 a.m. when it never showed up in Chicago. So, mm-hmm. But it was a moving experience. And, you know, for me personally, you know, having heard the step-by-step album and knowing it so well and seeing Stevie perform it two nights in a row from very close seats I was blessed to have, I just love that album because it was the first music he made after he got sober. That's mm-hmm. the whole theme of that album. And, you know, what a loss, because what else would have come beyond that?
He had, he was actually so far ahead of his time that I think right now that he probably had another 20 albums in him easily, very easily.
Oh, yeah.
Easily,
absolutely.
Too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And can you imagine him and Buddy Guy and Eric Clapton right now touring, going around the country doing a blues show, man? That would sell out every night.
Yeah, except I think at this point, at least for Eric isn't going to be doing much of that anymore. He's pretty much said he'll do a few one-off shows here and there, but the big full-scale touring of America is probably over.
Well,
yeah, you're right, though. There would have been some incredible music and performances over the years. But that's the kind of experience that working in radio, I've just been so unbelievably blessed and I'm grateful to have had, happy or sad, you know, there's been some really, really fine moments in that, meeting a lot of people around the country in the various cities where I've lived. And, you know, I think you've probably been through the same thing, although you stayed at KZPS for so long. You were there, what, about 15 years?
20.
20 years.
Yeah.
Gee, congratulations.
That don't happen very often.
No. Well, I remember when, you know, you guys first started using the Lone Star moniker, when you tried that experimental Texas country rock kind of format,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I would listen to you and I listened to several of the people on the air, you know, via streaming on the internet. And that was an interesting experiment, but I'm glad you're back. I'm glad Bo and Jim are back on the radio. It's good to hear them every once in a while. It's a video in the morning that I think Randy Ketchum does. It's like the warm-up video at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And Randy just talks to the audience. And, you know, I sign on just to take a peek, and he'll always spot my name and go, oh, hey, it's Jay. How you doing, Jay?
The thing about it is, man, is like, you know, you go through all that stuff. I got a chance to, you know, meet John Dillon, and I was there when John left, then he came back. And, you know, I found out he was a really, really, really genuine guy. You know, I mean, you know, people were always trying to smooth him and stuff, you know, but, it, you know, once he got to know you and saw how you really were, he would always be, you know, just the nicest guy. I've been to his home and had dinner there, met him in different places, he and his wife, Nancy. I got a chance to meet Redbeard. I heard all these stories about Redbeard. It's like, oh, Redbeard, you know, he's on top of the mountain, you know, and so I got a chance to meet him. One of the most humble and genuine guys you would ever, just one of the nicest people you could ever meet. It's like, I don't know, it's like meeting your, you know, your uncle or something, you know, that somebody you've always loved, and then he was always so welcoming. And, you know, I've had a chance to meet some really, really good people, legends in the Dallas-Fort Worth, North Texas area. And then, you know, of course, like in radio, you meet all kinds of, you know, something, you know, that you need to flush. You meet those too. So,
what was your favorite interview you ever did? You know, artist interview.
I think the Commodores.
Ah.
That was after Lionel Richie left, and it was only Wack, William King, and Clyde. And they had this new guy, J.D., and Lionel left. Ronald LaPrade, he retired. Thomas McClary, he retired. And Mylon Williams, he, I think he retired, but he got sick. And so I got a chance to sit back in Las Vegas, of all places. They were going to be at the MGM that night. And so they came by the station. I was doing afternoons, and they sat down, and we talked, and they asked me what was my favorite song, and I just, you know, I told them. They were just so nice and so welcoming. And then they said, hey, you know, we've had such a great time. Tonight, when we get through doing our show, well, come to the show, and tonight, come hang out with us backstage. And I was like, oh, man, You know, it's like, and I had bought I had bought every one of their albums. It got to the point where I didn't care. I mean, if the Commodores had a new album, I would go to the record store. You remember the record store?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Go well, to record store day is coming up.
Oh, yeah.
There are two of them, but June 12th is the first one.
Oh, so I go to the record store and I just pick an album out and I buy it. You know, and I go home, may not listen to it for a week or two. And then I listen to the hits, you know, that was on the radio, and I could, you know, see what was going on. But the Commodores were really, really nice, and that gave me a different feeling about entertainment, because these guys, they could have just, you know, been there, and I, you know, interviewed some people that I really kind of want to reach across the table and strangle. You know, it's like, here, let me strangle you, you know, and it's like, yeah, I don't really want to be here. Well, I know that, but can't you not be an asshole for 10 minutes, you know what I mean?
Okay, so who are you really talking about? Who provoked that kind of feeling in you?
I'd rather not.
I'll tell you mine. I'll tell you mine. You tell me first.
No, I'm not going to say. I can't do it. I can't do it.
Well, I can.
Okay.
It wasn't really an interview situation, but it was a deal where we had a lobby full of listeners come to the radio station where I was working, coincidentally Laser 103 in Milwaukee, and they were there to meet Billy Squire. That was the whole deal. Hey, we're going to qualify you to win, you know, an afternoon with Billy Squire and the Billy Barbecue or something. I forgot what we called it. But we had people out in the parking lot that were serving beer and pop and, you know, grilling out and all that. And Billy shows up. There are a lot of people that are just fine walking up and saying hi to Billy and, you know, shaking his hand and all that. Then there are the people that are kind of shy.
Mm-hmm.
And they need a little help. So I was kind of hanging out with those people and taking them one or two at a time over to make the introduction and kind of warm their way over to Billy, because they never would have approached him on their own. And about the third time, you know, I brought a winner over to meet Billy. And he goes, who's this guy? And I, you know, said the very colorful words I won't garbage up your wonderful broadcast with.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, it's this effing guy again. What do you want? They go, well, Billy, I'm just here to introduce you to some of your fans.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, didn't really appreciate that. And the other one was probably Pete Townsend. I won't say he was an asshole or a jerk, but he was a really difficult interview. And I was talking to him, and it was about 30 minutes before he'd go out in front of 40,000 people. I was trying to get him to talk a little bit about the show, what to expect. And I said, well, what do you like, Pete? Do you like being in the studio and recording, or do you like performing? Oh, I really don't like performing at all. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, there's a $1 million payday up there on the stage for you today, and you can't pretend to appreciate the people that came to see you. And it kind of went on like that for a few more minutes. And then I kind of just stumbled on the question about his hearing difficulties, because he has very bad tinnitus.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, man, did that open the door. All of a sudden, he was willing to talk, and he answered every question, and he just lit right up, because he was really passionate about talking about his hearing problem and trying to encourage other people not to go the way he did. And the way he described it, his hearing problem came not from being on stage or playing loud music, because The Who was always a very loud band.
Sure.
But from, as he put it, having a few nips in the studio and turning up the monitors, and we'd be drinking and cranking, and that's what did it, you know, the loud music in the studio, wearing headphones, whatever.
Well, man, how loud can that be? I mean, you know, we've all been in studios, and there's only so much the engineers will let you have. You know, I've been, you know, walking down the halls of KZPS, and they've had speakers they were testing. And the stuff off the ceiling would start falling, and the people on the next floor down, they would be like, we wonder what was going on up here, because we heard AC/DC just blasting away. I'm on the highway to hell, you know.
Well, I think that, you know, Pete Townsend is notoriously picky about his music, whose music, his performance, the production. And maybe they just kept playing certain drum beats, certain guitar stabs, whatever, over and over and over, until it was processed just right. And who knows how loud he was turning it up, or what, you know, high peaks of music he was constantly drilling into his head as he was listening, you know. Mm-hmm. You know what it's like when you're making an edit, or you're, you know, you're doing something and you listen to the same little passage of music over and over and over and over until you get it right.
Oh, yeah. You take the music and turn it up loud. And then you, like this show, I'll turn it up, not that loud, but I'll turn it up and I'll listen. There has to be, you know, when you're editing, there has to be a breath there. There has to be a pause, because it can't be just and everybody's like,
and when you're drinking,
yeah.
And when you're drinking, it's never loud enough.
Okay. Well, I can see how it could be that way. But then, Pete and Roger have always had, it's kind of like Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. They've had a love-hate relationship for years. It's kind of like, well, I'm joined to the hip with your ass, so I guess I'll just have to do the best I can. You know, Roger will come up and say, I hate this song, The Seeker. I was talking about it on my show in Raleigh, North Carolina on Radio Free Raleigh. And he was like, I hate this song, The Seeker. Didn't make any sense. It's like trying to push an elephant upstairs. And it's like, well, why did you record the thing then? It's like, well, that's, you know. And Pete is the one who makes the money, because he wrote 85% of the Who's stuff.
Yeah, you know, when we started talking today, I think before you flipped the switch and we went live, we were kind of joking around about Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
And, it's when I first called you. You answered the phone, and I said, hello, is this United States reaching? This is United States. Are we reaching?
Mm-hmm.
And that reminded me of a time, and I wish I could remember his name. It was Damon something, and he was the head of, I think it was Australian Pink Floyd. And I had an interview with him, and so I had it all set up to play that little piece. Hello, this is United States. Are we reaching? As he answered the phone.
Mm-hmm.
So he answered the phone. I play the clip, and he laughed and went with it, you know? And I thought that was a fun way to begin the call. It just loosened him up right away. You know, rather than a stiff, hello, nice to meet you, and yes, let's begin the interview now.
You know,
you know.
Exactly. You know, speaking of loosening people up, Redbeard told me a story one time. He said that, I said, who have you not interviewed? He named people to go on one hand of rock, you know, royalty, you know, sports people that were famous. I think Van Morrison, he said he never got. But he said he had a chance to sit down with Paul McCartney. And Paul was, you know, sitting there. I mean, you know, Paul, you know, he was nice. He was a gentleman. But you could tell, you know, he didn't know what Redbeard was going to ask him. And he said he went over and over and over in his head, what's the first question I'm going to ask? Because that sets the tone of the interview. And so he sat there and he's like, I can't ask you about Beatles stuff. I don't want to ask you personal stuff. So he found out, of course, that Paul McCartney was a huge fan of Motown's James Jamerson. And Paul would say he would go over, he would, Motown would put out a new record and he would be like, what's the bass player doing? He would sit there and go like, I never thought about that. So he said, he asked him, he said, I understand you're a huge fan of James Jamerson, the Motown bassist. So Paul lit right up. The rest of the interview was just like smooth as ice. And, you know, he was just like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, let me tell you, back in the day when my mates and I were over in Liverpool, you know, and all this, it was just great. So what you did was really cool, but I will make a statement. I bet Billy Squire doesn't have people walking up to him anymore.
No. Well, you know, a really interesting thing that I was yesterday old when I learned. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know about the whole Rock Me Tonight video, right?
Enlighten me, because after
Rock Me Tonight is a pretty good song.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out in 1984, and, you know, Billy Squire was, you know, big guitar hero for In the Dark and Everybody Wants You, and, you know, a lot of really great songs from his first couple of albums. And Rock Me Tonight was more of a pop hit, came out in 1984. But it is the song that destroyed his career, specifically the video, because it was just a badly themed video. It's not a good video, and he's kind of prancing around his bedroom, you know, in a tank top. And it just seemed at odds with the big, deadly guitar hero that everybody kind of envisioned him as. So, you know, it didn't do him any favors. Maybe that's where his attitude came from.
In a tank top? Press around the bedroom in a tank top?
Yeah. Look it up. The Rock Me Tonight video. You know, when I interviewed him and told the story about him, it was 1988. So it was about 4 years later, and he was probably still suffering from that whole deal. But what was interesting that I just found out the other night was a friend of mine was doing his radio show, and he devoted a good hour of it to the passing of Jim Steinman, who, of course, you know, wrote all the lyrics for Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell.
Yeah.
And he did work for so many other artists, Bonnie Tyler, Holding Out for a Hero, and Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Apparently he had something to do with the Billy Squire song, Rock Me Tonight, which doesn't sound at all like a Jim Steinman piece. Most Jim Steinman music has a real signature to it. Because you know what? The leap from Holding Out for a Hero or Total Eclipse of the Heart to Two Out of Three Ain't Bad or Paradise by the Dashboard Light isn't too great. Mm-hmm. Those are very overblown productions and bombastic lyrics written by Jim Steinman, who was really incredible. But I didn't know it had anything to do with Billy Squire. My warm-up question is to ask somebody, and I'm going to ask you right now, Ted. Okay, this is the icebreaker question. Not that we're having a bad time. What do you have in your pockets? Tell me what's in your pockets right now.
Nothing.
Okay, see? But now you feel closer to me, right? You want to talk to me more now, right?
I don't know. You want to get your hand in my pocket.
Well, now the awkward answer would be, well, I'm not wearing pants, Jay. That would be the awkward answer. I have another friend who did an unbelievably funny thing on the radio once. He's a talk show host up here. He was with KSDP Radio. His name is T.D. Mischke. And he always had a very unique way of doing his show every night on KSDP. And he did pretty much anything he wanted. And it was never a standard talk show. One night, just for fun, for the 2 hours he was on, he comes out of his intro and, you know, clicks a phone line onto the air. And so you can hear it. And you hear the caller going, hello? 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 TD? Hello? Am I on the air? And then he clicked another phone call and tied the two together. And this person's going, hello? And then the first caller's going, yeah, hello. And so they start talking to each other and trying to figure out where T.D. Mischke is. And they talk to each other for a little while. And to start going with it. And then he adds a third call to it, and he did this for 2 hours. The audience caught on to it and, you know, just kind of did their own show that night. I thought that was just amazing. And then the other thing he did once was he interviewed a shipwreck expert who had written a book about the Edmund Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal here in the Upper Midwest because, you know, we're Minnesota's right on Lake Superior. And, you know, the Gordon Lightfoot song is very, very popular up here. Gordon Lightfoot is himself very popular. He always sells out mm-hmm. when he comes to Minneapolis. You better get your ticket within the first 2 hours or you're out of luck. Mm-hmm. And so he had the shipwreck expert on the line, and he sang all of the questions to the tune of The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Hmm. And luckily, this author was, you know, has enough of a sense of humor that he went with it, too. Mm-hmm. And he just answered the questions. And you know, he had eight or nine questions, and he sang every one of them to the tune of the song.
We're having such a good time. It's got to be a part two because we've talked about Stevie Ray Vaughan. We've talked about Eric Clapton, Billy Squire, The Who. We haven't even touched Prince yet. So part two of hanging out with Ted Bouquet, my special guest and old friend Jay Philpott, will continue.